don't know the hour that finds me in this room. Dust around my feet and still no sugar in my spoon. But I've only got the taste for something sweet as thyme. Not bottled on the table, but still hanging on the vine.
Oh, good stuff. Music by Rhiannon Giddens this morning. A concert at the Egg in Albany. Our native daughters, Rhiannon Giddens, Allison Russell, Layla McCalla, and Amethyst Kia. That is tomorrow night, 8 o'clock at the Egg, theegg.org, for more information. And you can find the complete playlist.
Playlist.
Thank you. Playlist. The other one, not a good thing to say on the radio.
No.
Playlist, WAMC.org/roundtable. WAMC.org/roundtable. Good morning, everyone. Welcome. We were not here yesterday because of the Mueller hearing. So guess what? We're going to talk about the Mueller hearing. We got to get 2 days worth of stuff in. It is the 25th of July. It's 15 minutes past 9 o'clock, and we invite you to join us in the conversation panel at WAMC.org. All right, let me introduce the group to you. SUNY New Paltz, communications professor and former New York State Senator Terry Gibson. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Good. I'm so happy to be here.
Well, wonderful. We're happy, too. Hopefully, when you leave, you're still happy.
I will be. Sure.
So that's what we try for here at the Roundtable. Investigative journalist Rosemary Armeo is here. Good morning, Rosemary.
Good morning.
Always wonderful to have you with us. Look, College of St. Rose journalism professor Kaylin Brown is here. Good morning, Kaylin.
Good morning, everyone.
You usually can't do this because you're teaching and you get like 3 weeks before you go back to teach, so it's nice to have you with us.
And a bunch of us, it sounds like, are going to be back teaching.
Yes, absolutely. So good morning and welcome to the program. Dan Irizarry is the man of the hour. He is of Capital District Latinos. If you have been following the news of the last hour, Puerto Rico is the big spot on the map as the governor has finally decided to resign. And we'll be talking about that story in just a moment. Dan, thank you for being with us. It's a
good
great
to
pleasure
be with
to
you.
Have you on
Always.
The program. Thank you. All right. And Alan Chartok, good morning, sir. How are you?
I don't think I'm very well. I was just claiming on the Media Project that I was 82, and I'm 78. I didn't quite get why I did that, but maybe the older you get, the more old you think you are.
Well, I've always found with you that you always round up.
I round up, but not to 82. That's
no, not
for sure.
To 82. That seems to be over-rounding. All right. Well, you know, I think for, you know what, 78 or 82, you look great. So, there you go.
Well, thank you for that, Joe.
You're welcome.
After yesterday, I'm not sure that we should be, anyone should be boasting about being of a certain age, Alan.
Oh, boy.
Here she goes. And here
opening volley.
And hope.
Attack Mueller.
Hope.
Shots
here
fired.
Here we
Shots
go.
Fired.
All right. Well, what? we welcome your letters, paddle at WAMC.org, paddle at WAMC.org. So the story, of course, is the Mueller testimony. And the two takeaways seem to be, one, that the Mueller testimony didn't deliver the spark that the Democrats hope it would. That is one headline in the Washington Post. The other is a performance full of stumbles shakes a sterling Washington image. That of Robert Mueller, the special counsel, who was on the stand, if you will, was at the hearing yesterday, which we broadcast yesterday morning. All right. Many Democrats have considered former special counsel Robert Mueller a potential savior as the agent of President Trump's eventual undoing. But now the party is left with one option to end Trump's presidency, the 2020 election. In what was likely to have been his final act on the national stage, Mueller's halting testimony was at times painful to watch. So, Alan, let's start with you, and then I think Rosemary has some things to say on this. So let me start with you on your takeaways from the Mueller testimony.
Well, unlike Rosemary, I think, you know, he was an older man. I think he did well. He came out and said basically that the president was a liar. Now, look, this isn't the kind of thing that is going to change everybody in America. This isn't a smoking gun. This is a guy who did a two-year investigation, says the president is a liar, and as far as I'm concerned, there will be people, some people in the middle, people who have to make up their mind, who will take this to be a very serious piece of testimony. Now, look, Joe and everybody else, he said he didn't want to do it. And he said it because he probably knew what Rosemary's going to say, that it wasn't going to appear that he's it wasn't going to appear that he was really strong on this. He was not. On the other hand, I think he's a sensible, decent fellow, and we ought to applaud him for what he did do.
Blah, blah, blah. It was a painful, painful performance. I don't understand why the media and the left built him into a great mythic hero. He did a report that was incomplete, refuses to explain it, was forced to come and testify basically yesterday, and did an atrocious job that helped nothing in this debate.
Can I interject just for one question that
yes.
I have about that. Why did the Democrats call him then?
Because that's I could blame Congress easily. This Mueller, I think, did his report and said all along he was going to just do the basic asked of him,
right.
And that was it. He didn't even his letter to Barr saying, hey, you know, that was kind of like a bad summary you did. The media's got it all wrong because of you. That was pretty weak. He's never stood up for his report to explain or to defend it well. And Congress, it was in the ball. Is in their court, and rather than start impeachment or to continue do something, it's in their court. They thought he would be a savior, and the media again, even though we had the whole experience of the report coming out and it was nothing, it just added to the partisan conversation, the partisan fight. Again, said, "Oh, this will be different. Now we'll get to hear him, and everything will change." We bought into what the Democrats did: lazy, bad legislating.
Kaylin.
Mueller's performance, I think what the problem is, the word performance. He is not paid to perform in front of the media. He is paid to conduct investigations and come up with realizations. The Mueller report delivered some of that. Could it have gone further? Well, perhaps it could have. The fact that he's not a great orator does not mean that there's some problem with the work that he did up until now, but he did not come across as a well-spoken individual who could articulate.
Not just well-spoken. That I could understand. It wasn't that he was just stumbling. It was like he didn't seem to understand some of the points. The most controversial thing he said was an answer to a question. Yeah, I didn't indict because of the order of the Justice Department. And then he walked it back. He did not seem in command. I mean, doesn't that make you question the whole report? Certainly you're going to hear from the right that we ought to be questioning.
You know,
I agree he did not seem in command. I do agree with that. But again, the other people who were interrogating him were very scripted, and he
True.
Did not have the advantage of memorizing his 500-page report.
So you disagree with, I just want to make this clear, you disagree with Rosemary, right? Correctly so, or you don't?
Oh, we're going to have a vote on this?
I think it's nuanced, but
just a different perspective. I don't know that it's a disagreement. See, that's part of the problem. You're trying to polarize us. I'm not going to let you do that.
Now you sound like Mueller.
But you know, Alan, you and I certainly have done when you do interviews with people and you do them for their book, and sometimes you wonder if they've actually read the book. You know, like you seem to know more than they do, and you wonder if they've actually read the story that they're talking about. That's what I felt like sometimes.
Yeah,
it was he seemed distant from the report that was presented.
Schoolroom, we have a lot of teachers here. You sometimes have your students give oral presentations, and I normally would pick the students who turned in the best written report, and then I would be stunned at how they'd get up and speak in a monotone without conviction, and I would go, oh my God, it was so much, let me do it for you, and I would read the report and people would catch it, and that's what Mueller did yesterday. I'm sorry, yes, he's not paid as a performer, but he is paid to investigate, and he obviously feels strongly about Russian interference. But he did not make that clear either to the government or to us, and nothing has been done about that. That's the proof of how ineffective he was as an investigator.
Terry Gibson.
Well, at just putting on my professor hat. Speaking from a point of view of a person that's trying to teach college students how to be better communicators, I really did not think that Mueller did a very good job of communicating, and I don't think he has throughout this entire process.
Right.
And, you know, one of the things that I'm always teaching my students is to try to make sure they understand that if they take sort of a winding road narrative to try to make their point, especially if they're trying to persuade someone to change public opinion, it's really difficult to get there because your audience can't follow you. And what the Republicans have continued to do, I think, quite successfully, is they have capitalized on this confusing winding road narrative that Mueller has put down. And they did it again yesterday. And they've been able to point to that as being a deficiency. And they've used it to their advantage. And they have done a superb job of saying, look, it's incomplete. It's no good. It's inaccurate. Therefore, our president did nothing wrong. And it continues to work for their base.
But I...
Standing ovation. That was so excellent and clear. You are a communicator.
Yes, I agree. That was excellent.
But I don't agree. I think it was terrible.
But again, my question, Alan, is what I go back to at the beginning. If you're the Democrats and you're putting all of your eggs in this basket or all of your chips on this number, then shouldn't you know that this number is going to pay off a little bit better than it did?
Yes. All lawyers should know the answers to the questions they're going to ask before they ask the question.
Now let's go to Alan.
Were you asking me a question?
Yes, go ahead, Alan.
Okay.
That's fine.
So here's how I see it. This was not supposed to be the bomb that ends everything. It was something, and I think the something helped. Oh, come on now, Rosemary.
You're walking back from last week, Alan. Sorry.
No, I am not. And this is not an intelligent way to deal with a conversation. To go, that hardly does it. No, the fact is that Nadler asked the question. The answer was the president lied. That's what the answer was. It may have been a little nuanced, but you got it. And a lot of people were listening to that, and a lot of people know he lied. What's happened in this country is you have two sides, and nobody's getting off the stick. Right?
Sorry, Mueller never said the president lied. If he did, we might be having a different conversation.
He didn't use the word lie, but he certainly made the point over and over again that things that the president said weren't true.
The problem is that it didn't come across. We never got that moment that I think everybody was waiting for, and the media had built it up, and they were all asking questions about, is this going to be it? And I think what it's analogous.
That's the media's fault. Yeah.
Well, that's true, but it's also the Democrats' fault because they keep on waiting for this bombshell to fall or for somebody to come in and rescue them, and they are reluctant to do the work that they need to do.
So would they have been better off if Mueller did not appear at all?
Yes.
No.
I'm not sure. I'm ambivalent about that because those people who are listening, maybe the independents who are listening, got some further confirmation that this is a rotten presidency and needs to go. But if you want to talk about, you know, who won and who lost.
Yeah, it's a tie. I think definitely I would defend no. If he had testified in a closed session, he might have been more forthcoming, and that would have been useful. But it would require Congress to do its job.
Right. So in my watching of the coverage yesterday, it took the Democrats about 15 minutes before they were like, well, this is going to be a lot better when we get Don McGahn on the stand.
Yeah, they're still punting their responsibility.
Yeah, well, I think even Adam Schiff and Jerry Nadler both, I think, you know, both of their opening comments were, I'll tell you right now, if they were in my communications class, they would flunk because they spend way too much time trying
You're a
to—
hard grader.
They spend all their time trying to convince everyone how intelligent they are instead of actually getting to the point and trying to put words down in a straight path that the American public can understand. And they spend 10 minutes talking, you have no idea what they said.
Do you think Schiff wasn't as effective, though? I thought he was pretty effective.
I'm talking about in their opening comments. When they're actually
opening comments were very good. Yeah,
but you're an intellectual. The audience they need to reach is not an intellectual.
You can call me any name you want. Well, and this is not meant to in any way deprecate you, Senator. Because you ran for Senate, you won, and then you lost. These guys are two of the most intelligent, forthcoming people in the country, and they've done extremely well, and they succeed politically, which they have to do. Now, if you take that as a knock on you, you would be wrong.
I would just point instead to Trump speaking in front of the helicopter with all the noise in the background, and his performance was far more memorable and visceral, which is, it's all a hoax, disproved it, it was disgraceful.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Clear, simple sentences, calling on the same information that you're saying made an impact, and he used it to his own point.
So
he's
Leanne,
the better communicator.
Leanne wrote in and said, I listened to the entire hearing and disagree with the assertion you are putting forth about the Mueller, about how Mueller represented it. Please don't diminish his team's work by stating what you feel. I love the roundtable, but I'm not thrilled this morning.
Good for Leanne.
I don't know what you mean.
What, you don't know what?
I don't know exactly what she means.
Well, I think
she means you're wrong.
No, she means you're wrong.
On the contrary. No,
perhaps Leanne is looking for a more fact-based analysis than
I think she's saying that there were a lot
reactions.
Of I think
yes.
there were like a lot of we're rating a performance, as we were saying earlier, and that there were many, many facts in there that were deeply troubling, and that I don't want to put words in her mouth, that the team did a great job in unearthing a lot of this, and we are forgetting that fact.
But you know, I don't think anybody's disputing that there are obviously very troubling facts here. You know, what I'm personally concerned about is the ability for especially the independent voters in America to be able to process what's going on here and how important it is in 30 seconds or less. And unfortunately, the Republicans are finding ways to spin that message to benefit them, and the Democrats can't seem to figure out how to do it.
You have 30 seconds or less. we actually now only have 18 seconds. So just in a flip to Leanne's note, Jay writes, dear panel, simply put, Mueller came off as old, weary, and with no information. So we're divided, at least in the audience so far. We'll get to more letters and get to your comments and come back to all of this in just a moment. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back after this.
There is no sickness, toil, nor danger in that fair land.
Right. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Shartok, Terry Gibson, Kaylin Brown, Dan Arizari, and Rosemary Armeo. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. We do have letters like this one from Lynn, who says, Rosemary is right all the time, but not in this case. He did seem to have memory problems. It has been suggested that problems arose during last months of his tenure, which was known to the Dems. I think given his lapses known to his team and later to the Dems, I feel angry that he may have been used in his debility.
Wait, didn't I say wrong. It's similar to Reagan. Yeah, he didn't get Alzheimer's until after he was done being president. Right, I believe that too.
Lynn sure has a different thought on that in her book. Okay. Lisa says, it's always weird when there's a name and it says from, and it's different than the person who signs it at the bottom. So I have to get used to that. So Lisa says, the scariest, sorriest thing that happened yesterday was Republicans, now fascists, blocked protections of our elections. What has Putin promised the former Republican Party members in exchange for allowing him and other countries from interfering in our elections? Dems must step up and investigate this farce of a president and force people to testify. If Trump wins 2020, we will never be able to go back.
And how do you force them? That's an interesting point. I mean, you know, there's no question that the president has said to McGahn and others, you can't go up there. You may not go up there. How do you force them?
Well, there's news this morning that the Judiciary Committee is going to court to fight for the subpoena against McGahn.
Yeah,
so that's
and
one
by the
way.
Time it gets, and by the time it gets to the Supreme Court, Rosemary,
the
we'll
wheels
have
of justice do not move quickly, Alan. You know that.
Well, of course, and that's my whole point. And that's exactly what this president
is
up to.
It keeps looking like that. The Democrats have brought a straw to a gunfight. They look like it's like Wile E. Coyote, and the roadrunner, and Donald Trump is the roadrunner, continuously outpacing on messaging, on communication, and the Democrats keep having the safe, the Acme safe, falling on their head like it happened yesterday.
Wild E. Coyote, stable genius.
Count on me for Looney
Tunes. Did you all watch the chairman last night? Did you all watch the chairman last night of the three committees and Pelosi, you know, basically trying to put a face on all of this?
Right.
I wondered how you think they did.
Not well. Their division was evident.
You mean the division over impeachment?
Between the three.
Among the three. They don't know the best route, and they don't agree on the best route, let me put it that way.
I think Nancy Pelosi was a winner yesterday. I think, you know, her message all of a sudden was reinforced by the lack of information that came out of this hearing.
Yeah, that's true.
So I think she was the real winner in all of this.
Can I ask a question? Because a lot of this is in her court, but to what you were all just saying a moment ago, I mean, the 2020 elections, it's far off, but how much of this, how much do you want to fight all of this while the election is going on?
What do you mean?
Meaning, is it helpful for the Democrats or Democrat in later on who is running for the presidency if we're still going after all of this stuff and having hearings? And does that help or hurt?
I don't see any evidence that Donald Trump's illegal behavior, which it clearly is, seems to be an election issue right now. I think that it doesn't seem to be helping the candidates or the party. I think people are still looking for information about policy, about health care, about income inequality, about the environment. I think those are the issues
that what many of our listeners say is that it's going to come down to 2020. Forget impeachment. We as the people have to vote him out. That's what we have to do. And so if the Congress is still fighting amongst itself as to what to do and impeachment and so forth, does that hurt in that goal?
Increasing evidence is that Trump will win again in 2020. So if I were a Democrat in Congress, I would keep those investigations going so that when he is in 2020, and they may not be, that's another problem, they can step in and impeach them.
Nick,
that's right.
I think this Richard is a really...
Alan, I'm sorry, I'm just go down. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say that Richard Nixon didn't get thrown out until the second term.
Correct.
And he won overwhelmingly, knowing about Watergate.
Correct. Biggest election victory in history to that point after the Watergate revelations. Right.
I just wonder what's going to be left of our institutions at that point when he's ostensibly in for a second term. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's so much damage being done. Right now, so much undermining that is not being talked about because all the oxygen in the room is being sucked out by this. Well, and I'm not saying that it shouldn't be. I'm not saying that it lacks an importance and it's not critical. But we're in a game with a guy who is a master of branding and communication, and he's out-branded and out-communicated the Democrats, and the Democrats are still trying to find the right message.
I know we mentioned... Go ahead, Alan.
I was just going to say, and so was Mussolini. I mean, I see such parallels between these two guys. And we know how Mussolini ended up.
Yeah. And because the Democrats are obligated to both investigate and try to win back the presidency, we need to keep going on both fronts. I mean, the people mm-hmm. who are involved in those efforts need to keep pushing forward because one does not ever preclude the other. They have to work harder because they let it come to this.
But the big problem here is that this country is divided. We all know that. We've said it 1,000 times between one group who are basically could be characterized, maybe unfortunately, as the haves and the have-nots. The haves come out. They vote in large numbers, concentrated numbers. The have-nots do not. And until that changes, you're not going to have a change in this because the haves will not get off the dime. They are sticking with their story and with their candidate. Even though they find him personally repulsive, they know that that's what this is all about.
Daniel writes, the Dems didn't put all their eggs in one basket. That's why they are continuing other avenues. Mueller said numerous times that Trump lied. Why are you losing the forest for the optics? Didn't we used to call this perjury? Val Demings, Director Mueller, isn't it fair to say that the president's written answers were not only inadequate and incomplete because he didn't answer many of your questions, but where he did, his answers showed that he wasn't always being truthful? And Robert Mueller said, I would say generally.
You know, sooner or later, we're going to have to find out what the relationship between Mueller and this president were. Is anybody else interested in the fact that this president, for some reason, keeps on clobbering Mueller again and again, calling him all kinds of names? He's a terrible person, and Mueller doesn't fight back. Now, we know Mueller was appointed, but we don't know why he was appointed, and we don't know what the relationship was. Put another way, who has what on who?
I don't know. Mueller just strikes me as a very straight-laced public servant who just isn't willing to get down in the mud to that level. And I just don't think he's going
to
do it.
Yeah, I mean, up to the hearing, we kept hearing that if the Democrats could just get Mueller to read his exact words, it would be powerful. Did you notice he didn't read anything? Even when asked, he said, I would prefer for you to read it. He is not playing at all. And yes, he did the report. But it's a five. Again, the investigation was ineffective because it wasn't presented right.
When he chose not to read that, Rosemary, I thought that was a smart political move because I think it was about inflection and about how you deliver information.
And he couldn't.
Or he couldn't read it. Or he was trying to protect himself somehow from being misconstrued. That was just how I understood what was happening.
I agree with you.
You know, one of the more powerful moments to me was he did actually say that a president that did the things that were documented in this report, especially in the obstruction front, could be indicted out of office. So it tells us right then and there that these are very serious charges.
Okay, well, here's another point that came out. What is the OLC? Why is that rule that a sitting president can't be indicted so powerful? Yeah. It seems to be taking precedent over law or the Constitution. Right. When did it come into effect? How do you undo it?
I couldn't agree with you
isn't
more.
Isn't it guidance?
It's guidance. Yeah, exactly.
I mean, there are politicians in New York State that are in jail right now that have done far less things than this president has done.
Yes.
There are politicians around the entire country and the world that have done far less things than this president has done that are in jail. Why can't we indict this president for breaking the laws?
Is he above the law?
No one questioned that. Not the Democrats, not the Republicans, not Mueller, not Barr. Why is that guidance? It's not even a rule. That seems too strong a word.
He's not king. It's like all of a sudden we have a king instead of a president. It's very frustrating.
I have two letters I want to get to, and then we'll take a break. And when I come back, when we come back, I want to go to Puerto Rico. But Goldie writes, Mueller warned us in the most uncertain terms that our elections are in danger in 2020. What about that? Why aren't we pressuring Mitch McConnell to bring the electoral security to a vote in the Senate?
That's the message they should have been promoting from day one.
Yes.
Forget all this other stuff.
Yes.
Prosecute that case. Yes. That's what they should have
done. And also, there's an interesting individual who is going up against Mitch McConnell in the election.
She's awesome.
Yes, she is a fascinating person who is worth people exploring. And maybe New York dollars need to go to Kentucky.
Andre writes that sadly the Democratic Party has failed miserably to focus on the only thing that will beat Trump, substantive and convincing policies that will resonate with enough voters to secure victory in 2020. If they continue to waste time on anything else, they will succeed brilliantly at shooting themselves in
Elizabeth Warren has been doing
exactly.
that.
Exactly.
So, no.
And Hillary did in the last time, Hillary, and it made no difference. I wish that were true, but I don't think it is.
No.
The haves versus the have-nots. I'm telling you, that's what this is about.
All right, let's take a break, and we will continue. We have a great panel. We welcome you to join it. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. The governor of Puerto Rico announced late Wednesday that he will resign effective August 2nd amid intense pressure from inside and outside his government after a series of leaked chat messages denigrating his opponents and Hurricane Maria victims triggered outrage from frustrated citizens who had taken to the streets for 13 consecutive days. of protest. Ricardo Rossello had defied calls for his resignation as the island descended into upheaval. He lost support from nearly everyone in his ruling statehood party, and more than a dozen members of his administration had stepped down in recent days, including his chief of staff on Tuesday. So, Dan Arizari, let me ask you, first of all, of what you make of this, and second of all, how was Puerto Rico able to motivate its citizenry to take to the streets for 13 days and yell bloody murder?
Well, the history of politics in Puerto Rico is one of engagement. Typically, I remember going to the island in the 70s and seeing how much activity there was on the college campuses and the Universidad de Puerto Rico. There's always been like this nexus of all of these issues coming together and people motivating around them. I remember during the nationalist uprisings that have been typically in Puerto Rico in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s, you have a group of people, an intelligentsia there, that has repudiated and has fought against colonialism from the beginning. So you have the roots of, you've always had the roots of a movement in Puerto Rico of the people that are against the status quo. Of course, you've also had a group of people who are the moneyed interests who have always benefited, like governors, from the colonial structure. You can call it Commonwealth. I know Alan will disagree with me about that word, but it's a colony. And what has happened is the combination of what's gone on with the debt crisis, the combination of the exodus, the diaspora from Puerto Rico, and what happened post-Maria has really outraged the remaining people of the island to the point where they will not suffer this type of indignity anymore. And I think it's a combination of the frustration, of the realization that the colonial status of the island has left them bereft. And if they don't do something and stand up for themselves, they will continue to be the paupers of the American experiment.
Hey, Dan, I don't disagree with you at all. No, I think that's right. However, when given a choice, they have never voted for statehood, for example. How come?
I believe that when you think about the poverty on the island being 40% of the people living under the poverty level, the median income, I think, is somewhere around $19,000 a year. I think that you have created kind of a welfare state in Puerto Rico, where so many of the people are dependent on Section 8 housing, on food stamps, on some type of assistance. And so it's almost like, and I hate to use this analogy, but it's almost like trying to get somebody off of using drugs and saying, you know, what do you think? Do you want to like stop using, or would you like to continue using? And the person says, doesn't really have a choice because they're addicted. So what are they going to say? I got to stay here. I want to keep getting the drugs from you.
And yet, Dan, you still have 100,000 or 200 or 500,000, some reports say, people out on the streets. So what's the difference between this uprising and the voting that goes on, which says we want to stay with what you've just described?
So it takes a bit to go back to what has happened over the past 10 years, or since the financial crisis, the larger financial crisis, starting in 2008, 2010. Everything in Puerto Rico moves slower than on the mainland. Mm-hmm. So in the 1929 crash, the United States recovered at some point far into maybe the 30s. It took Puerto Rico probably twice as long to recover from the Depression. The same with the financial crisis. And then you had the debt crisis explode. And then you had PROMESA, the PROMESA board put in, and austerity measures instituted. You lowered the federal minimum wage. You halved it. You told teachers and public workers that they could no longer benefit from their pensions because of this financial crisis. So each and every one of those factors is closing in on the population. And I guarantee you, Alan, that plebiscites notwithstanding, the people of Puerto Rico are at the point where they've realized this colonial relationship must end if we are to survive as a country.
Okay, so just to be clear, because I don't disagree with you, if there was a plebiscite tomorrow, as you just put it, another plebiscite, and you gave people a choice between statehood or independence, which is always the case, statehood, independence, or continuing the way they are, Commonwealth, what would happen?
If I had a crystal ball, I might be able to tell you. But here's what I think has changed. I think that all of the talking points of the Republicans on Puerto Rican statehood, do you know what Mitch McConnell said about it? He said, I'll be damned if I'm going to allow the Democrats to add another Democratic state. Another socialist state.
That's how come we got Alaska and Hawaii, because it was one-on-one.
But the problem is you have a Republican majority that's never going to do it because they see Puerto Rico as just a dump and a place where...
That's not what I asked you. I asked you if there was a plebiscite tomorrow, Dan. And you've given a remarkable explanation on both sides of the issue. People have had it on the one hand, and two, they're dependent on it. What would happen tomorrow?
I think that statehood might edge out the Commonwealth status. I think the Commonwealth status, nobody believes that it can work anymore. Statehood might win out, but I think people are beginning on the island to understand that that is not a viable option, and neither is Commonwealth.
So and the third choice, the independence?
There's always been a hardcore independentista support among the population. I think the right has successfully branded it as socialist and communist, and because of Cuba, they've always, you know, suppressed that movement on the island.
So let me ask about the next couple of days here. So Roselló resigns, and that'll come in the next couple of days of him actually stepping down. Normally, the Secretary of State would take over, although a new Secretary of State was not named after the previous one resigned for their role in the group text messages. And then that leads the Justice Secretary, who's also a target of intense criticism in Puerto Rico. So what are the next couple of days going to be like?
I think that's a good question. I have no answer to that. I think that it's funny. I think today is Constitution Day in Puerto Rico because for the first time, I think in 1950, Puerto Rico was able to draft its constitution. Having said that, I think that you bring out a good point. There's so much corruption that where do you go to? Where do you reach in order to find somebody who has the public confidence to be able to lead the island out of this most precarious
moment? So what's the next
moment?
Election? When's the next election?
I think it's on the same schedule as the presidential, if I'm not mistaken.
Which means another two and a half years.
The mayor of San Juan, who is extremely popular, wants to run for governor.
That would be awesome.
But you can't do that for 2.5 years.
And I know this isn't important, but how do they get the text messages? I mean, that's fascinating to me.
I haven't read anything about the leak, about how the leak happened, but it was leaked to a local blogger. Those 889 pages of texts were leaked to a local, small-time information sharer, like a citizen journalist.
Right.
And the CPI, the big nonprofit.
The ProPublica of Puerto Rico.
Thank you very much. Then went ahead and shared that. Lin-Manuel Miranda's now on board. So, you know.
Oh, that clinches it.
I got to throw that out there. You know, journalism was at the heart of this.
Oh, no doubt.
So it's important that everybody is supporting journalism. And you'll hear more about that in the Media Project next week.
I'm just fascinated of how they actually got, an encrypted text message.
There is nothing private anymore. Didn't you know that, Joe?
It's better than that. There are always whistleblowers because even in the most corrupt and horrible situation, there's someone who's saying this is not right, and the word gets out.
Where are the whistleblowers in the White House? We need more of them.
We need more. No, it doesn't do any good here. We print tons of stuff. There's been amazing investigative reporting on our White House.
These text
messages do not care that he is dishonest and corrupt.
But these text messages messages aren't any worse than anything that Trump has said.
Well, no, Trump is much worse.
Well, that's the whole thing. I mean, what it's encouraging, and I think Rosemary made this point, is that you have American citizens, albeit in a different cultural setting, that just the mention of some of these things. For instance, he talked about women being daughters of whores.
Right.
And making
LGBT,
fun.
Yeah. Ricky. He went after Ricky. I want him to be president.
Yeah, yeah. And
you
so
you can't go after Ricky Martin without a fight.
So it's encouraging that the people would take such a stance over what we now consider to be normalized behavior.
Yeah.
And
that says
a lot about our condition, doesn't it?
I told Dan on the break that I wish we had would be the opposite of deportation, forced immigration, and bring over a whole bunch of the organizers
right.
and the people who demonstrated so effectively in Puerto Rico and give us some lessons here.
Well, along that point, if you allow me, in Florida, of course, the importance of the electorate in Florida is incredible, right? So you talk about the Orlando area, the I-90 corridor, is that what it is? So I feel that the Democrats, if they don't look at that as an opportunity and spend a lot of money organizing those Puerto Ricans who are the, I think they've outnumbered the number of Cubans, if I'm not mistaken.
Interesting.
It might be. If they would put dollars and resources and people on the ground to mobilize the Puerto Rican community, I think Florida
difference.
Would be in play. And I think the Republicans look at what's happening with the Republican Hispanic outreach effort. It's in disarray because Trump's people kicked out the grassroots Republican organizers input, and they're outraged, by the way. So I think you could even pick off some of those Republicans who know what happened on the local level and are disgusted with the Trump operation. And if you did that in Florida, we're talking about a whole other electoral map here.
Dan Arizari is on the panel this morning, along with Alan Chartok, Terry Gibson, Rosemary Armeo, and Kaylin Brown. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We'll go with your letters and other stories as well. A lot going on in the news today. We'll get to as much of it as we possibly can, and we'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. It is very nice to have you with us. And let me introduce the panel to you, Rosemary Armeo, Dan Arizari, Kaylin Brown, Terry Gibson, and the birthday boy, Alan Chartok.
Happy birthday.
Yeah.
Happy good morning. Birthday, Alan.
Is he there?
Yeah.
Oh, there. Yeah. I thought you were blowing out the candles there. I didn't know what you were doing.
No, I'm here. You know, these birthdays get to be a little less important as you get a little bit older. That's all I have to say about that. It says Forrest Gump.
How are you celebrating today?
Sitting on my keister.
Oh, that's good. That's good. All right.
Yeah.
Well, Lisa said, Alan, we just want to thank you for all that you do for our community. So
that's very nice. I really appreciate that.
And Antoinette says, Puerto Rico showed us that citizens can take to the streets and demand that offensive, corrupt leaders be removed if the facts stated in the Mueller report are not enough for Americans to get up and protest to save their democracy from a felonious president and foreign election interference. What is ?
Can I ask Dan a question about that? I've been thinking about the Puerto Rican experience, 500,000 yes. people coming out doing it. There are basic cultural differences between Puerto Rico and the rest of the country, yes?
Yes, and I think it's just, as you say, it's a cultural thing. And I'm not trying to argue that, you know, bring out the old trope of, well, we're so passionate. But I got to tell you, when it comes to politics and love, we are extremely passionate. That was a joke, Alan. I just wanted to. And I remember hearing stories about how the PNP and the other party, I can't remember, Las Pavas, and that those were the parties. They had symbols, and if you had like a symbol of one party, you got into an argument. People would go back home and get a machete and, you know, threaten each other because they were so passionate about their positions. I mean, there's definitely a long history. And remember—
And a love of homeland, right? I mean, in other words—
Absolutely.
As opposed— talk about others. My Puerto Rican dissertation advisor, who I loved, would take me to a place to eat, and she'd say, "Alan, the cook here is so bad they must have imported him from England."
Well, we had a poet laureate, Juan Antonio Correger, who was also counsel to Albizu Campos, one of the fathers of the Independentista movement, who was jailed by the United States for a long period of time, died of cancer in a prison in the U.S. Juan Antonio Correger was an incredible poet, and he wrote this poem, and I think it answers your question, Alan. It talks about the story of an immigrant family from Puerto Rico, and how the mother died working in the factory floor, the father died. And this young man that tells the story says this wonderful line. And he said, and it says, "And anybody who would dare tell me that I'm not Puerto Rican now," this is someone like me, who's second generation. Mm. "If anybody would dare tell me that I am not Puerto Rican, they would have to fight me." And then he goes on further to say, "I would be Puerto Rican even if I were born on the moon." So that tells you what the pride of being a Boricua, being a Puerto Rican, is. And it's an innate, I can't explain it other than to say I rarely see anyone from Puerto Rico who doesn't have that type of pride in their country.
All right, let's go to the other letters. Josh writes, "Esteemed panel, I recall hearing many panel members last week say they expected no new bombshells and for the Mueller testimony to be a disappointment. It was both of those things, yet many on the panel today seem angrily disappointed. Mueller did exactly what was predicted. I think the Dems did a great job clearly running exposition of the glaring corruption of the campaign. Trump will be indicted day one after leaving office."
I guess I don't have to say that's a great letter.
Well, I think one thing that was demonstrated clearly, I don't know if the panel agrees with me, is the vile and abusive and nasty tone of the Republicans in their remarks. I mean,
as if every word had been written and scripted by the White House, right?
No. Sean Hannity. CNN did a comparison about all the talking points, and it seemed like in every case, Sean Hannity had previewed it the night before on Fox News.
Absolutely. It had all been scripted.
And you know, you can take those talking points they're using right now in Washington, and you can go to any state, including New York, and anybody that's on the Republican Party ticket as a candidate or an incumbent is going to be using the exact same
talking
points.
Absolutely. And there's the effectiveness of the message and keeping on message.
And by the way, I interviewed the new chairman of the Republican State Committee yesterday, and he was there. And of course, Elise Stefanik was doing the same exact thing. They were all saying the same words. That's one thing the Republicans do well.
Well, so did the Democrats. They were all scripted too. They had a mock rehearsal to plot their questions. So
it's true. But
and why didn't Mueller? I mean, why wasn't he better prepared? He had people there who were supposedly helping him look for sites, and he didn't. Yeah,
we have duped this one out already, so I'm not going to go back into that. But basically, I think he did a good job. I think he's an older man. He said he didn't want to come. He said what he was about, and he was.
All right, we go to Antoinette, who says Puerto Rico showed. I'm sorry, I already read that. Let's go to we're done with the letters. Let's go to another topic. All right. I had them in the wrong order. Let's go to North Korea. That's another story. Well, what's going on in North Korea? They have fired a new type of ballistic missile into the sea toward Japan, we are told. North Korea fired two short-range ballistic missiles off its coast, east coast, into the Sea of Japan on Thursday morning, according to the South Korean government, and the first such launch since President Trump met North Korean leader Kim Jong-un in late June. They were launched near the coastal city of Wonsan at 5:34 and 5:57 a.m. respectively. South Korea's Joint Chiefs of Staff have made the announcement in a statement, with officials later saying the first missile flew about 265 miles at an altitude of about 30 miles and the second traveling some 430 miles.
So here's the question for all of you. The Japanese say they're very nervous about this. I would be too if I were living in Japan. However, I do want to ask a question, and that is, does anybody on the panel think that this guy is capable of firing a missile at either South Korea or Japan?
I think that I would lean towards yes on that question, because he strikes me as the type of person that has the type of sort of dictator-like mind and ego that could be persuaded to do it.
The more important question is, if he did do it, I agree with you, he certainly is capable of it, would Trump react? Would the U.S. take any action or still be in love with him?
Well, I think that's what a lot of this is about. I think both North Korea and Iran, I think, are the same. They're really testing.
Yep.
They're
Trump.
Testing this president.
Yep.
Except that Iran is not next to China. Right.
Yes, different, different. Yeah.
Iran is in the Middle East.
It's a different thing.
I know that. But if there was a whole...
That's not geography, but I'm sorry. I mean that it's just as important and just as incendiary as military action near China.
Yes, however, if we put a hole in the ground where North Korea is, and that's what we could do, obviously, China is right next door.
Look,
and there's a big difference.
You made the point right there. China is behind Kim.
Yep.
And you think about it. I mean, how does anyone not see how feckless the foreign policy of Donald Trump is?
Yeah.
3 weeks ago, he was at the demilitarized zone posing for a picture. And now we have this.
Right.
So what's going on, guy?
Yeah. What are we to make of it? Is it a coincidence that this happened on the day of the Mueller hearing? Throwing that out there.
And I think it's going to be a long, long time till touchdown. No, that's the song. I'm sorry. That's Rocket Man lyric. Rocket Man lyric. Illusion.
Well, it's clear that this president has no foreign policy that really has any logic to it, and has no real signs of achieving anything since he took office. And so all foreign leaders are taking advantage of that any way that they can, and they're starting to form these coalitions, some of which have been forming for a long time, some of which are new, and they're all about trying to take advantage of Donald Trump's sort of senseless policies that nobody really knows what he's going to do.
Yeah.
Okay. No disagreement on that fact.
No.
Okay.
Good
so where
analysis.
Do we go from here?
Except.
Oh, go ahead, Alan.
I'm sorry.
There must be somewhere to go.
But except that he does have a policy. Everybody keeps saying he doesn't have a policy. He has a policy. It's a terrible policy. It's personal. It has to do with him and his needs at any moment. But the fact of the matter is that if he thinks that if he keeps everybody jumping on one foot, that he will, in the end, represent the American people. Let's face it, right? Over 45% right now of the American people like what Trump is doing. The New York Times says he could be reelected president. So, Rosemary, I guess this question is for you. Are the American people really so stupid that they don't understand all of that?
In a word, yes.
Well, you know, the only problem is we had somebody, a political figure, who used the word deplorable to describe these folks, and we all know where that ended up. It didn't help at all. And I think that we really do. The Republicans, some of the voices on the Republican side who are saying the Democrats are making a mistake in continuing to pursue this idea that everybody who voted for Trump is stupid. And I think that is correct. I think that we have to understand, and there's a lot been written about it, about how much damage was done to people during the financial crisis who never recovered and who were embittered and who went to the polls because this guy promised to burn the house down.
And yet 500,000 Puerto Ricans get out on the street with a passion that is unimaginable in this country, where 50% of the population, and I'll tell you which way it leans blue, 50% of the population don't bother to vote or register.
Alan, you know, there's something to be said about the educational system in Puerto Rico, even though the elementary educational system is very bad. But you have a vibrant university system in Puerto Rico. You have a large group of young people who are educated, who can speak English, who are not sitting around, cutting sugar or walking around cutting sugarcane in the fields. These are young urban Puerto Ricans who understand and who have seen firsthand what this political structure is doing to their future.
And
their
yet
lives.
You have made a profound point that many have gone away from Puerto Rico. They say, well, I can't do that, so I have to go to Florida, into that panhandle you talk about. And the question is, will that passion in Puerto Rico be transferred to other places that they have gone in terms of registering and voting and being part of the political system?
Well, Alan, I hear you loud and clear. And if Tom Perez is listening, if he doesn't invest a lot of money to get those Puerto Ricans from the diaspora who are American citizens and eligible to vote out in the I-90 corridor, they will be missing a huge opportunity to shift this. Because all you can say all you want about the hearings and impeachment and all this other stuff, but if you don't have a ground operation that takes advantage strategically of some of these opportunities, like the opportunity to galvanize all those Puerto Ricans into a voting bloc, I don't know where your head is at.
Well, but did it take a ground operation to get 500,000 people? Everything we're reading is no, they just came out. Now, what's the difference? You go to Florida from Puerto Rico. At that stage of the game, does your culture kick out as opposed to kicking in?
No, I think you have to take into account the conditions under which people have left the island.
Let's remember that Florida is where this election is going to be determined.
Well, that's what I'm saying, Alan. I think that if you make the right appeal and you have the right message to that community, and you spend time and resources, forget about what the island versus the mainland issue is. If you do it methodically and with purpose and you have the right message, I think you can galvanize. Because I don't think that you lose your passion when you cross over from the island to the mainland. I don't think that is true.
Well, I think it's the Democrats' challenge. The Democrats have to harness that passion, not just in Florida, but across the country. And you're absolutely right. Mm-hmm. Organizing a get-out-the-vote ground game should be the Democrats' number one priority, certainly in the major states like Florida.
Okay, so if they're not doing it, why aren't they doing it?
Because they're chasing impeachment, because they're involved in 1,500 different investigations, because...
What are they, stupid?
No, that's Congress. The people should be doing this at the Democratic National Convention and the candidates. And they're not distracted by impeachment.
So, Rosemary, do they want to lose?
They seem to be working that way. And I want to go
back to...
You think
they purposely won't... Wait a second.
Why are they not talking... They are not talking about these issues. They have bought this line, and we've talked about it here, that they have to get out big policies on health care and all this other stuff. And I don't think that's going to win the election. I think it's all getting down to who's going to vote and issues of passion. And I'm sorry, I think that there is passion here, and it's come out in voting for Trump, who it was stupid for them to vote against Trump because it was demonstrably against their own self-interest. But it was a finger to the elite and to the people who have been ignoring them. That is not stupid like I'm putting them down, but it's patently behavior that hurt them.
Well, I don't want to self-promote, Alan, but I did write a piece in the TU, a commentary, a couple of days ago.
That'll do it.
And what happens is, towards the end, I talk about how Trump has treated the Hispanic community, how he has used it as a political piñata. And at the end, I say, and the sad part of it is that he's coming for the most ardent Trumpistas that are out there. Look at his budget. Yep. Look at the proposed budget. Look at what he's doing to food stamps. Look at what he's doing to social services. Yep. And I'm telling you, those people, because he doesn't care about them.
Farmers, coal miners, he did the same thing here. The people who supported him are getting hurt the most.
Absolutely.
But those who are in universities, and Dan talked about this in Puerto Rico, those who are in universities here in the United States are obligated to be part of the movement and part of the grassroots yes. efforts. In the classrooms, our students have that energy. They have the foresight to see that if they don't vote, there will be more trouble for them. And as Dan said on the break, the playlist of their lives will read as this negative, negative, we can't solve anything, but they can, and the youth will do it. I believe it.
All right. We have to go. Nice way to end. Thank you very much, everyone. Terry Gibson, Kaylin Brown, Dan Arizari, and Rosemary Mayo, thank you very much. Alan, happy birthday to you, my
friend.
Happy birthday,
Alan.
Happy birthday, Alan. Happy birthday.